RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
I have travelled to the gently rolling hills of Sussex to meet royal designer Terence Woodgate, a man known for his exquisitely purist approach to design, making him one of the most sought-after designers in Europe. But his beginnings were far more humble. A no-hoper at school, being plagued by dyslexia, led him to leave full-time education when only 15. While working as an engineer, he stumbled on a furniture design course that was to change his life. Hear too about his fascinating and innovative collaboration with the renowned Formula One racing car designer, John Barnard, the outcome of which produced one of the most beautifully elegant pieces of furniture ever designed and was the toast of the Milan Furniture Fair 2 years ago. I spoke to Terence at his home in the depths of the Sussex countryside.
Now, you were born in 1953. That was a kind of momentous year for the UK because it was the coronation.
True, yes.
It was the conquest of Everest.
Yes.
Yeah. And also, because of the coronation, there's a proliferation of television. After all that post-war gloom, things started to look up. But I guess for you, your formative years would have been the 60s, which in itself was another amazing decade when there was an explosion of creativity and everything sort of came together. And I'm just wondering whether you were the kind of boy that was watching things like Fireball, XL5 and Stingray and Thunderbirds and
definitely
that sort of thing.
Space Patrol.
Yeah.
Gamma Ray on.
Just tell me a bit about your young life. Where were you born?
I was born in Camden Town. So I grew up all around Parliament Hill Fields and Kentish Town, and that whole area. And then later on we moved, probably when I was about 9, St Albans Villas, which is up by Parliament Hill Fields. So we always seemed to remain somewhere around Hampstead Heath, Parliament Hill Fields and Hampstead Heath. So I spent most of my life around that area.
And what did your father do? What?
My dad was a stonemason and my mother was a housewife. She worked during the war. She always looked back on as a very enjoyable time, but she remained a housewife.
Were you a particularly creative child?
I loved Airfix kits, building models. And I think I was probably that generation that overlapped Meccano and Lego.
Yeah.
You know, so sort of screwing things together and getting those little steam engines going. And so I always, I loved creativity. I loved making things. I think making...
Do you think that was a reflection of what your father was doing with stonemasonry work
? Don't think so at all. It's just what I picked up from whatever was in there at the time. You know, all those wonderful craft programs were on television as well, showing you how to do things. You know, the wonderful Blue Peter, how to put together things with a toilet roll and kitchen foil. And I loved all that.
So at school, were you sort of moving towards that direction?
Not
direction
at all.
Of creativity? What were you excelling at?
Not much.
Or not.
Not much at all, actually. I mean, I failed my 11 plus. I went to Holloway Comprehensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I was only good at technical drawing, woodwork, art, and mathematics. And it wasn't until my son was diagnosed with dyslexia that I realised that I am dyslexic. I thought I was just thick.
I think, many of the interviews I've done and certainly lots of people that I know that in the creative field I think there's like an 80% ratio of dyslexics in the creative field that seem to excel on the practical and visual side. Mm. Literally reading numbers and words often becomes very confusing. As you say, it's at a time when that sort of thing wasn't really recognised. You were steered towards woodwork and metalwork rather than anything academic.
A trade. And I remember when I actually discovered I had something I could put a name on, you know, because all up till then I just thought I really did think that I was thick. And then all of a sudden in the middle of the night I realised, oh my God, can you actually be thick and dyslexic?
So this sort of technical side, did you feel that was the path you would take simply because you were not very academic, but you had this ability to
Yes, I think you...
With practical things.
You're drawn to things that you can do, and that you enjoy. Mm. And I certainly never enjoyed English. I enjoyed geography superbly. I mean, I always wanted to travel, and I loved maps. History and English, I could have easily left, you know. In fact, I would skip most of those classes if I could, if I get away from them. But woodwork was great, and had wonderful teachers. I mean, I think you always look back and think, well, you have someone who's just enlightened and gives you the time and space to actually learn.
Mm.
So mathematics was something I enjoyed very much. I found I was quite good at that. But you know, again, just drawn with geometry and trigonometry and actually understanding space and volume. And
so you're at a comprehensive, failing your 11th plus. What happened to the latter part when you got to, if there were such a thing at that time as sixth form, I guess the sixth form.
I left before fifth form. I took an O level when I was 15,
mm-hmm.
and I went and did a engineering apprenticeship. So when I was 16, I was already an apprentice. Yeah.
So you were, I think you were specialising in, was it sort of pipe work at that point?
No, at that point it was just engineering. I actually did my apprenticeship at Gordon's Gin. It was a great introduction to alcohol and engineering at the same time.
So what sort of engineering would they be doing at Gordon's?
Well, they had a bottling plant, of course. So they would be making all the machines to make the bottling.
Right.
So I was helping to make and do the drawings for various parts to make the machines. I mean, one thing we were doing was the little crest, the little wax crest on the Tanqueray bottle. That was actually, in those days, was made of letter wax.
Right.
And we had to get a little brass stamp that would stamp it.
Oh, I see. So it was actually a seal on the bottle.
It was actually a seal on the bottle, yeah. So the bottle was come over at an angle and it would squirt the right amount of wax out and then stamp it on. So.
Oh, right. Okay.
And it had a bottling plant.
So how did you graduate then from Gordon's engineering department to further your career?
Well, like I said, I always wanted to travel. That's really what I wanted to do. So, it was really trying to fund my trips, and I found that I could quite a lot of money doing petrochemical piping design to make.
So, what's involved in petrochemical piping in terms of design? Literally,
it's just routing. It's routing the pipes and putting the valves in the right places. And I mean, we're doing oil rigs, you know, and you have. They're three-dimensional spaces where you've got to...
So how long did that go on for? You say it was to fund your travelling, so did you drop out at some point and travel?
I took a job as a freelance designer in Brussels, and that's where the money was super, and funded my motorcycle trip, you know, the motorcycle trip through Europe, and spent the whole summer motorcycling around Greece, and then bumped into some people that had a Land Rover, that I just aborted a trip to South Africa, and I ended up buying their Land Rover from them. And I'd read, you know, Siddhartha, Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, and I really wanted to go to India. I mean, ever since I heard Revolver, I was fascinated by Indian music and India and that whole. You know. And I think I probably wanted to go there and discover myself, my real self. And of course, it's never like that at all. But so when I was 22, I drove off to India.
And how long did you stay there?
It was about 6 months. You know, a fantastic route that now is very difficult to achieve through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. I mean, all the towns that you hear on the news, you know, through Tehran and Mashhad and Kandahar, Kabul,
places that Jalabad. you certainly wouldn't want to
park up on the road and just go to sleep and you know, that's what we did. But you know, I've always been very naive and very optimistic. It's a very dangerous combination.
So after your travels were over in your Land Rover, you drove back to the UK
back to Brussels where I lived, and I met Paula, fell in love.
Your
with
to
Paula,
be wife,
who's
yes.
my to yes. be wife, my current wife. Paula has some really, really good friends in Brussels. Una, an Irish friend of hers, had an Italian boyfriend, a guy called Mario Ferrucci. And Mario through Mario, I got to visit lots of exhibitions. I mean, he was a great he was a lover of art and design. And if we'd go to trips up into Amsterdam, we'd always go to the Stedelijk and see what was going on. If we all went to Berlin, we would go and see exhibitions there. And through that, I really got introduced to design, and I can point it back to, you know, a couple of exhibitions, one by Oscar Schimmler in Amsterdam. And I felt like the chap from Boys from the Black Stuff, you know, gives a job, I can do that. Yeah, Yossa, I can do that, gives a job. And I thought,
just suddenly related to this, quite late on really, 22, to suddenly start picking up. Is it something you just felt a connection with that you hadn't noticed before?
I think it was always there. I mean, when I was always in engineering, I always looked at machines and thought, you know, that looks nice, that looks more elegant, that sort of way of doing things.
Mm.
So I think the eye was always there, but it never had a sort of focus, let's say.
Yeah.
And those exhibitions certainly helped me focus on the interest. And so I then got very interested in the decorative arts and so that. But it wasn't until my 30s, really, that I went back to college and trained as a furniture
designer. Before you go on to that, because there's a story that I want you to tell which amused me on reading about it. You
really
continuing with the pipe work, apparently you worked on the Lloyd's building, and you were Lloyd's building, Richard Rogers building.
Yeah, we were
working on the pipe work. There's plenty of pipe work on that building. And you were in a porter cabin, and the story has it that you suddenly got up one day from the porter cabin and left for 10 minutes and never came back. Is that...
It's true. I was working there, and the manager was someone I didn't get on with at all. And one lunchtime, I walked out, and I walked up to the Commercial Road, and I actually went into the London College of Furniture, and I discovered that they had a course. It was called the Diploma in Furniture Design and Production, and I found that I could get on it. And it was wonderful. It was one of those sort of abstract courses that... It wasn't a degree course. You didn't have to have any particular qualification to get on the course, just a desire to do it. So we had all sorts of people on the courses, from musicians, architects, authors, all people that just wanted to do something different. And so we had a terrific, terrific time.
So was this a day course, a full-time course?
No, it was a full-time course. It was a two-year full-time course.
So you gave up, presumably, a reasonably paid day job.
Yeah, I gave up my job. And anyway, so having gone to the London College of Furniture, I then went back and wrote on my desk, back in 5 minutes, and walked out. To fund my life through college, I still did design. I did drawings, as built drawings of factories and things like that. So I would go into plant rooms and draw all the pipe work and stuff like that, and give them drawings.
So this used to be a freelance sort
of business. Yeah, just to pay the bills, just to get through it.
So the furniture course was at the Guildhall?
It's now called Guildhall University, or Metropolitan University, I think it is now.
Yeah.
But then it was called the London College of Furniture. The course director was a chap called Tony Crowther. And Tony was terrific.
And did you find that, how did that sort of manifest itself with you, working with wood and furniture and looking at how things were?
I was different, I think, from most people. I knew what I wanted to do. I really just wanted a bench and a workshop and access to machines. And I was quite a difficult character when I was there, because I got very fed up when they would have their tea breaks and they would turn off the machines. And I could never understand why they have to turn off the machines just because they're having tea. Why can't I continue to work? And why can't I use the machines at weekends? And why can't I work into the night? You know. And it would annoy me immensely to think that all these machines were just sitting there during the holiday period or at weekends, and I couldn't have access to them. So when I could have access to them, I was really dedicated. I really had a vision. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. There were a few design briefs that I had to meet, but I was already designing for myself, really. I mean, I never worked for anyone. I never worked in the business, let's say. I never worked for a design studio. I never worked for a, you know, furniture maker or cabinet maker or anything like that. I just...
And you came out, started your own studio, and then started to forge relationships with manufacturers.
Indeed. And it's all been, I think my whole career's, it's never been planned. It's just happened through a series of conversations. And I remember working on one design I did for a company called Mines and West that are no longer around. but I did a lighting connection. It was a connection for a table light, and someone suggested that it would have, you know, another benefit in lighting. Could become a good, you know, light design in its own right. And through them, I was introduced to Concord Lighting, and that was a relationship that started in 1989, and I've been designing for them ever since. I mean, I designed something for them about 3 years ago, and at the same time, I designed a cabinet system that I showed to Craig Allen, who was then the buyer at the Conrad shop, just really asking what he felt. You know, what he felt about the work, and he liked it, and he suggested that the company to make it would be Punt Mobles, and that he was actually hosting a talk at the Design Museum on Spanish design, and that Vicente Martinez was going to be there, and if I was going to be there, you could introduce me to them, and I actually had already tickets for this talk, so and that's what happened. I went there, met Vicente, and explained that I had this design, and they were very nice, but they said, oh, you know, but we've got production that's set up for the next 3 years, but, you know, we're come along anyway. So they came along, and it was in April time, and by September it was released in the Valencian Furniture Fair, and our relationship has never stopped. You know, they've become terrific friends, and I still design for them.
And I mean, at that time, were you inspired by other designers? Were you aware of what was going on generally in the world of furniture design, and also the kind of history of furniture design? Is that something you picked up when you were at Guildhall, or were you fairly kind of insular?
No. I mean, I studied that, and I mean, I probably had a deeper understanding of design history because ever since I went to those early exhibitions in Holland, you know, then I started buying design magazines, and just then I had an interest in that whole world, and I knew just about all the Bauhaus designers, of course. You know, still one of my favourite designers was Charles Eames. I found it incredibly inspiring, not just because he did furniture, but because he did all the other things adjacent to furniture.
But also with him, a kind of way of life as well. I mean, everything he seemed, there was nothing that he didn't appear to touch.
No, and everything he did touch was well presented and beautifully photographed. And it had a, you know, it was probably before people understood a brand, but, you know, he even more than Herman Miller, had a brand about him.
Mm.
Even the toys that they brought about. So, no, I had pretty good understanding of the work, but design wasn't, this was the late 80s. Design hadn't kicked off in this country really much at all. It was still very much Italian design. Later, I mean, Memphis had sort of happened while I was at college, which really went straight over my head. I'm not a great person for decoration, as you probably appreciate, but I did find it exciting. It was an exciting that there was a different a new direction.
It was at that period when I think postmodernism was beginning to rear its head, and Memphis was very much in the ether at that time. I mean, buildings started to have sort of holes punched through them and pediments and all sorts of strange things that seemed to be, you know, the opposite to pure modernist principles.
I know, people who were diehard modernists all of a sudden became postmodernists. You know, Philip Johnson all of a sudden did building with a decorative top to it, you know, with a pitched facade. It was strange. And of course, unlike a piece of furniture, you know, you can just push it to one side, but with a building in the centre of New York, it's there forever.
So in the late, the late 80s, actually early 90s, 91, you moved to Belgium. Why did you move to Belgium?
Well, I lived in Brussels before. I met Paula in Brussels. We had lots of friends in Brussels. We lived in the UK. We had now two children. Paula, her job really sort of fell apart then, but she could get a job in Brussels. And for me, it really didn't matter where I worked. It didn't matter at all. And I thought it'd be nice. It would be a nice change. And it was. It really kick-started my career. All of a sudden, when I moved to Brussels, I became an international designer. Even though I hadn't changed at all, I just changed my address. But people make those assumptions. But it was super to be back in Brussels. I mean, the wonderful thing about living there is if you get in the car and drive 3 hours east, you're in Germany, in Cologne, and if you drive 3 hours south, you're in Paris, in the Loire Valley, south of Paris, or north of Amsterdam. So there's so much, there's a different culture, different languages, different museums, different galleries, different music, different cultures completely. Whereas in the UK, you've always got to cross that stretch of water, which is...
Did you find being in Belgium affected your work? I mean, how affected are you by the environment around you when it comes to...
I don't think I'm affected by it at all. I think I have a pretty clear understanding of what I want to do. I mean, my work is very driven by geometry and precision and trying to get an exactness about something and a balance and playing around with things. I mean, sometimes the environment has an effect, like Sussex, for example. I mean, I just drive into down the road one day, I saw this barn that had a weatherboard facade, but in the middle of it were these two doors that were rusty and they just looked awful. And I thought, why don't they make those weatherboard the same? They'll all sort of blend in. And then I came back, I was working on this cabinet design, and you know, lo and behold, we came up with Sussex, and it was a natural. And I think that's the thing about designers. We see, and all these things filter through, and that's what makes us what we are. That's what makes designers what they are. It's how you filter them, how you filter them out, and how you channel them into your work. So everything has an effect eventually, I'm sure. Even all those aborted designs always come, some aspect of them come back, and they're put into other work, and it becomes more successful because of it.
After Belgium, you returned and you set up a new studio where we are now in Sussex, which again is undergoing major change because, I mean, as we're sitting here, outside there's a lot of building going on. You've got a new studio in the garden, which looks very impressive, although I haven't seen inside. But it's in a terrific spot, very isolated. Tell me a little bit about the process of setting this studio up. And you work completely alone, don't you? You don't have assistants, it's just you.
I don't have assistants as such. I can use people around me. You know, there are various people that could make prototypes, and there are cabinet makers, there are ceramicists, there are different people that I can call on and use. So I'm not restricted by that. I don't need to have anyone around. I think I've always enjoyed the freedom. Freedom's always been important to me. For me to, if I feel like working, I work, and if I don't feel like working, I procrastinate. You know, I'm a great procrastinator.
You've never felt the need to work with other, you know, creatives in a wider creative environment.
No,
you don't need that sort of buzz of energy from others. You're quite happy.
No, I think I get it in all different ways. I mean, I the easiest way for me to get that buzz is to visit a gallery or a museum, and it doesn't have to be in my own discipline. I mean, if I went to an exhibition of photography and saw wonderful images, it would make me want to rush back and work, because I just love creation. I don't need to be around other people to make that happen. That's what I do.
It's quite interesting because, you know, that it varies from person to person, but I've always felt that the idea of absorbing as many of the other creative disciplines as possible is always enriching, because it does, in the end, you suddenly see things from a slightly different perspective. Okay. If you expose yourself to whatever it might be, ceramics, for example, or, you know, or cinema, or theatre, or sound design, or music, all of those things
absolutely
have a powerful effect on you.
Sure. I mean, when I've ever been a visiting lecturer, I've always said, don't look at your own discipline, look at other adjacent disciplines, look at jewellery, look at architecture, look at motor racing design, you know, anything, because it's inspirational, and you're less likely to, you know, plagiarise other designs, because, you know, you have some new influences coming from art or from culture that's around you, and I think that's very important.
You just mentioned motor racing then, I'm going to go on to something now. Certainly over the years, you've built up some very good relationships with different manufacturers. I mean, SCP being one. I mean, you're one of their designers, and many others. Established and Sons another. And it's Established and Sons I want to talk about, because I want to talk about Surface, which appeared a couple of years ago, I think, in Milan, and was the kind of star of the of the show at that year, simply because it was so extraordinary. This is the table that you developed with another royal designer, John Barnard, who was famous for Formula One racing car design. And I'd just like you to tell the story about how that came about, and also the collaboration, because you've just said you don't like work, you're happy not to work with other people, but here was something where you did work with somebody else, and the end product was an amazing piece of work. So just tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? Well, it came about through you originally. You asked me to help put together some talks at the RSA, and the idea was to emphasise the diversity of the disciplines. And one of the ideas was to put together two disciplines that you never ever come together, and that's engineering and fashion. And Betty Jackson stood in for fashion and John Barnard for engineering. And I thought it would emphasise the differences, but of course it did the absolute opposite. It emphasised the similarities that, you know, most people don't realise it, but racing cars are made out of fabric. And Betty and John almost use a similar machine to cut fabric. And the people that make racing cars tailor, you know, a two-dimensional cloth to create a three-dimensional shape, and in a very skilled way, almost like a, you know, seamstress. And through that, I met John and invited me down to his factory, which was the old Ferrari factory that he inherited from his time at Ferrari. And I was just, frankly, jealous. You know, jealous of all those exotic materials that motor racing get to use, but I never get to use in furniture design. And coming back, I had lunch with two of the directors of Established & Sons, Mark and Tamara, and said, you know, explained that, you know, I was jealous of all these materials. And they said, well, why don't you ask John to collaborate? And I thought about it on the way back, but I kind of dismissed it. And then I thought, well, worst that can happen is he could say no. So I rang John up and he jumped at it. He said, I've been, you know, dying for people to work with on furniture design. So that was it. So we sat down and trying to decide what we should do first. And a table seemed a nice challenge, structural challenge for the material. And we wanted to use it. We wanted to experiment with the material because it is a very exotic material and it's a very expensive material. So we wanted not just to create something that looked like any other table, but in an exotic material, another material. So we wanted to push it and try and create something with a very, very strong aesthetic that would be difficult to achieve any other way. Because it's not just the thin top, it's also the very, very thin legs, and it's the carbon that allows the top to be very, very light, have very little mass. Otherwise it would, you know, oscillate. And it's been a terrific experience. I mean, it's spent most of the time with me interrogating John about his Formula One experience, which is fascinating. I mean, he's a tremendous designer. I mean, he really is a brilliant man with a great mind, and we've been working on other projects since. And it's interesting to see how someone thinks about things.
I mean, for people that haven't seen the table, that it spans 3 meters, I think, at least the latest incarnation is.
The limited edition goes to 4 meters.
4 meters. And it's 2 millimeters thick.
It's 2 millimeters thick at the edge, which is where the legs fit.
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty. I mean, we just wanted it to look like a normal table with legs at each corner, but just to push it. And the reason it's called surface is the definition of a table is a horizontally supported surface. So we wanted it to be just that, just the surface, and not to have any perception of thickness, edge. Mm. It needs thickness further in to the table to give it structural integrity. It needs some strength.
And it's just left in its natural state, which is sort of
indeed,
black, brushed sort of finish.
Yeah, there's a carbon cloth, which is called unidirectional, which, as it says, all the carbon goes in one direction, as normally the cloth is weathed. And because of the table, we needed unidirectional cloth to go in the length of the table, and it's not normally seen. It's structural material. It normally is normally underneath the finished carbon, but we thought it looked really nice, and we thought it had a great honesty about it, and no one had ever seen it before. So we wanted to sort of expose it and celebrate it, and it's quite special. It was very interesting because when the first weave we got was quite wild, with lots of broken strands, and when we spoke to the suppliers about trying to get a better quality visually, they just asked why, you know, why? Because they never, it's an issue. It's not something that they ever have to contend with.
No.
But we looked around and we finally found something which was a little bit more tame.
And you've developed a chair now to go with it?
Yes, yeah. We developed the chair to go with the table, which was more of a challenge, really, because we obviously were constrained by the aesthetics of the table. So we had to put, you know, trying to keep the legs very, very thin and trying to have thin legs at the extremity of the chair creates a real challenge. And that's where you know, John's in-depth understanding of carbon composites comes in. We've produced the chairs. It's done in an aluminium closed mould. It has a skin, very, very thin skins that put it together.
And are you planning on working on other projects with John, or is it? Do you think it's come to its end?
No. We have a pet project, which is our folding bicycle, which is very exciting. And this is more driven by John. In this case, this was his idea, and asked if I'd like to work with him. And, you know, I naturally jumped at the idea. And we went to the Eurobike show in Friedrichshafen in Germany, just to look at other folding bikes, and we realised that wasn't anything like what we wanted to achieve. Mm. So we're working together on that right now.
Well, that, I mean, that...
In fact, I've been looking at tyres today.
It's interesting that, you know, you're both working towards bicycle, which brings me on to, you know, sustainability and resourcefulness and all of those issues that are beginning to come to the fore in terms of design, you know, and the whole meaning of what design is. And I wanted to talk to you a bit about design. And for you, for example, how has design changed in the years that you've been practicing?
I think it's become more disciplined. I think it's become much, much more thoughtful, much more holistic, much more honest. I think the, you know, choice of materials has a certain, you know, with sustainability. I mean, the environmental issues have been around for a long time. Designers have been dealing with them for a long time. You know, they were never enforced to deal with them. They were looking at those right from the very beginning. So I think they've been very proactive with those, a lot of those issues. The table was something, an indulgence really, with an exotic material, but it's a material that is in other aspects is very environmentally useful and friendly material. I mean, the new Boeing aircraft are being made out of carbon composites. In fact, the off run of the carbon is what's used on the table. So the end of the runs from the Boeing is the material that we get to use.
I mean, it would seem just in pure experimentation and pushing design, that table is very important because it shows, you know, what can be done, and it shows something that hasn't been done before. So that in its own right is of value, even though I know the table itself is hugely expensive and way out of the reach of anybody in the... You know, every day.
It's true, but you know, the thing about composites is that, you know, it's very, very labour intensive and it's very skilled. Once you can de-skill some of that work, which you know, may well be possible, either through the use of machines or you know, cheaper labour, it maybe it becomes more viable as a material, but. You have to experiment with things. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about Formula One, or was in the past when it was much more in John's day. It was a much more innovative period. I mean, you know, John created the first carbon fibre monocoque. Now every single car on the racing on the grid is made of carbon fibre. He created the hydroelectronic sequential gearbox, and which is the paddle shift. You know, this pre-select gearbox. You know, every single car now on the grid. And it's migrated to road cars now. Mm. And all those ideas, some of those ideas are actually infiltrating now into the design of our bicycle, for example. You know, and so everything experimental, it all filters through in some way, shape or form.
And I mean, the very fact you're creating a bicycle, it's a form of transport that's becoming increasingly more and more popular. I mean, certainly living and working in London as I do, I'm very aware that high volume of bikes now. I mean, not like Holland, of course, because the environment's not the same, but it really is becoming more and more the mode of transport for London. So it does seem interesting that you're doing that. I mean, just...
Well, we're both cyclists. I mean, yeah. John and I ride bikes, and we've ridden bikes all our lives. And, you know, I used to race bikes, and they're fantastic things. Mm. They really are fantastic things. But, you know, it's interesting when you look at one, and you think, well, what can we bring? What new innovation can we bring? But when you do look at it holistically, it is quite interesting what can be achieved.
I'm just thinking for a moment about how design was used during the wartime period. You know, there was a sudden need for products and homes to be put up rapidly and furniture that could be made quickly and easily. And so you had the utility mark furniture, yes, and you had prefabricated houses, and designers were mobilized to solve those problems because there was a need. What do you think the world needs from design today? How do you see, for example, your role in society generally?
Designers are brilliant at working within the constraints. I think with any design, the most important thing is to understand the constraints and work within them. And those constraints can be just constraints of material, of cost, of ergonomics, of production, of processes, and more recently, you know, sustainability and the environmental issues are other constraints. And, within all those constraints, there is a very, very perfect area to design where you meet all of them. And again, this sort of goes back to Charles Eames's idea that you don't
have to
compromise. If you design within the constraints, you don't have to compromise. There is no compromise. If you ignore any of those constraints, then you have to compromise. So in other words, if I designed something today and I ignored certain issues of sustainability or recycling or material, anything like that, then I would have to compromise. And that's a disaster, I think, from the point of view of a design. It's not been designed by you, it's been compromised by your lack of care, really.
So I think I read something recently, a piece written by... I think it's Mark Adams who runs Bitzer, about Dieter Rams. And what was interesting about the piece, he was just talking about, you know, the longevity of Dieter's work, not so much obviously the radios and the radiograms, because they've been superseded by iPods, and it's a whole different world there. But his shelving system, for example, which is still being manufactured.
His influence is immense.
You know, that the design of that shelving system hasn't really changed. I think it's maybe been, you know, tinkered with, but it's the same. I would think for any designer who cares deeply about their work, the idea of your piece enduring and actually not just appreciating the value, but being useful for over a long period of time is sort of becomes, well, I'm not going to say paramount, but it must be very rewarding when you discover that you produce something that people like and it becomes a classic.
I don't think anyone sets out to... Well, I think you always hope that it's going to be classic. I think you always design to transcend fashion, something that's going to be around for a long time. I know I certainly do. And I think that's what's important. The issue of recycling, in many ways for me, the best thing you can do is to design something that doesn't need to be recycled, that will outlive its use. Outlive you, probably. You and I.
Well, a lot of furniture does, doesn't it?
Well, indeed. And it's still around and still relevant and one issue. I'm very interested in quality. I think that's, if you design correctly, you can achieve incredible quality of the work. And that, again, that's another constraint. And I think that, going back to your earlier point about what can designers bring to today, is understanding those constraints and designing within them, I think, is absolutely paramount.
I just want to go on a bit to, you know, the term designer and all of the derivations over the years of designer drugs, designer this, designer that. And there's a new camp that is suggesting that you can transfer designer thinking to anybody, I guess, you know. And I just wonder what your view on that, being a designer and having been a designer for a long time. Do you think it's possible to transfer designer thinking to the majority of people? And if so, how do you think that could happen and what benefits would it bring?
I guess we're all designers. It's just some of us are better designers than others. It's almost like everyone's a chef, but Everyone's a cook, but not as good as others. I would like to think that you could, but I'm not really sure that it's possible.
Okay, one example I wanted to bring up about collaborating, if you like, with non-designers, and that's really collaborating with skilled craftspeople, was a project that sadly never came to be, but I think it was going to be a very exciting project.
Which is RSA India.
This was the RSA, Royal Society of Arts India, approached the Royal Designers to pair up a craft base in India with a Royal Designer here to really push the boundaries of what that craft could achieve. And I think you set out with another Royal Designer, Georgina von Estop, to produce some furniture, and it sounded as if it was going to be, you know, really very good, and unfortunately it didn't happen. But that seemed to me, going back to the earlier question of transferring, you know, designer thinking, it seemed to me that would have been an environment where your thinking and skill could have been transferred to a craftsperson to perhaps think a little differently rather than in a mechanical way, maybe seeing things slightly different. I don't know. It was just tell me, I know it didn't happen, but just tell me about the process that you were going through, because I know it involved India, which you love.
Yeah, it was a very exciting project, and we had some, you know, world class designers that bought into it. I mean, you know, Jasper wanted to be involved. I know Matthew Hilton wanted to get involved, Robin Levine, I think Ross Lovegrove wanted to get involved. And it for one reason or another, it just never happened, which was really quite tragic. But it would have been a fantastic synergy, I think, or symbiosis between craft and design. And again, not just that, but also, you know, Eastern craft with Western design. It would have been superb. And I think the exhibitions would have shown that work, and it would have been successful. I've no doubt about that at all.
The other thing I wanted to touch on is you've been to one of the RDI summer schools, which ran for 7 years, and unfortunately is not happening this year. But I just wanted to, simply because one is dealing here with getting together 30 to 40 young designers who are, you know, not students, they're not just, some of them have been perhaps running their own business for maybe six to eight years or so, and it's taking them away out of their normal environment to you know, an isolated place, as in the case sometimes it was Dartington, and really just to spend some time really thinking about what it is they're doing as designers, and being exposed to far more experience on an equal level, you know, designers that have been practicing for many, many years, and just having a four-day period of having often abstract notions to deal with. But what do you think, having been on one of those yourself, what value would you bring to that sort of setup, which to a lot of people may appear to be a lot of designers just having a nice time for a weekend away from the hubbub of London?
Well, I mean, it certainly was that. It was a lot of designers, a lot of people having a very, very nice time together, but because they're all equally minded people. I think the value is immense. I mean, I know I got a lot out of it, and I'm absolutely certain that all the, what do we call them? Other designers.
Young designers.
The young designers got an awful lot out of it as well. The projects were superb, and we weren't there to hold master classes or anything like that. We actually got involved just as designers with another group of younger designers to complete various design briefs. It's very difficult to quantify, and I think that's always been one of the problems with the summer school. And it was explained to me that I would have difficulty explaining it to people when they came back. I mean, I tried to explain to Paula what a fantastic time, and you know, it was a bit like someone trying to spell something for me. You know, there's words just floating around in my head. It was a very similar way of trying to explain what happened there. But it was just that immersion with other like-minded people. And I think a lot of those talks, those discussions that happen over breakfast, over lunch, in the bar, they were as important, if not more important, than actually doing the design briefs. But it was that balance of seeing other things and taking other people's viewpoints and challenging yourself. For me, you know, as you mentioned, you know, I don't work with other people, so all of a sudden I was actually thrown in with, you know, maybe 12 other people in our group working through, one of which was Kenneth Grange. So, you know, it was an awful lot of fun. I think the summer school's terrific. I think the people that are involved in it's terrific. I think the balance was fantastic with the wildcards. You know, the idea of a wildcard is just incredible. So just in the middle of all these designers thinking about design and talking about design and how they're going to make the world a better place, and all of a sudden, you know, you have a soldier or a dancer or an astrophysicist. It was fantastic to have that and those discussions. I look back at it as a really valuable time, and it's a shame that there's not going to be one this year, but I'm sure they'll carry on in some shape or form.
I think we've come to the end now, but I mean, we're sitting here in your house and your studio will be finished soon. What plans have you got just to carry on being Terence Woodgate design, or have you got a grand scheme lined up? Are there areas of design that you haven't yet tackled that you'd like to tackle?
Oh, I'm sure there's areas that I'd love to tackle. I'm going to get more involved in lighting. That's something that an area that I've always been interested in and always been involved in. And I think it's a very interesting period now with lots of new low energy light sources. LEDs now are coming to the fore and are now becoming very, very useful. So that's a very exciting period. Working on the bicycle with John is something I really, really want to find more time to get into.
Do you see it? Is there a timescale for that? When do you see that actually coming to fruition?
No, we probably need to put a timescale on it. Otherwise, we'll probably drift on like we did with the table. I mean, the table should have been shown maybe a couple of years before, but we had to fit it in with Formula One manufacturing peaks and troughs. You know, we could only do the work when there was a trough. No, we really must persevere with the bike. And I know John's working on it right now.
Well, I look forward to seeing you and John riding around with it. Terence Woodgate, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike.